Hey, everyone. It's a hard news Monday, and we're going to get through it together. It's the takeaway for April 22nd, 2019. First up, a series of suicide bombings in churches and hotels killed hundreds in Sri Lanka on Easter Sunday.
This is unlike anything the country has seen, and this is a country that is used to experiencing suicide bombings, but not at this level of coordination, not at this scale.
Also, 20 years after the massacre at Columbine High School, we talked to two principals who've experienced shootings.
From probably those first moments, I knew this was going to be something that will change my life.
And the Violence Against Women Act is up for renewal, and domestic abuse survivors are pushing Congress to close the boyfriend loophole.
I think that putting the onus of violence on the victim is very naive because there's only so much you can do to stop someone from killing you.
Heavy stuff, but we need to talk about it. Let's start in Sri Lanka. Over the weekend, communities around the world gathered for the Easter and Passover holidays. But in Sri Lanka, Easter Sunday took a tragic turn in a series of bombings carried out at multiple churches and hotels across the country.
One man, in fact, recalls seeing who he later saw on the news was able to confirm was one of the suicide bombers. He described being at Easter Mass with his family and then noticing this man sort of from the corner of his eye with a very, very large backpack walking really briskly down the aisle of the church. And seconds later, he heard this explosion and it was just chaos thereafter.
That's Emily Schmall, South Asia correspondent for the Associated Press, and she's been reporting from the Sri Lankan capital city of Colombo. At least 290 people have been reported dead and roughly 500 injured in the attacks. And among those killed, more than 39 were from countries outside of Sri Lanka, including the United States, the UK, and India. The exact motives behind the attack are still being determined, but on Monday, Sri Lanka's government said the attacks were carried out by 7 different suicide bombers, all Sri Lankan nationals. The government has also said that the attacks were coordinated by a radical Islamic terrorist group called the National Tawhid Jamaat. Following the bombing, Sri Lankan officials have admitted that some members of their government were warned of a possible attack being planned by the group earlier this month.
The health minister today said that as of April 4th, a number of intelligence reports from intelligence agencies around the world had been shared with some members of Sri Lanka's government, its head of police, for example. And in these documents that warned of a possible attack, this group's name was mentioned. But for some reason, this intelligence didn't reach the highest echelons of government in Sri Lanka.
The country is almost 10 years removed from a 26-year-long civil war between the Sri Lankan government and the separatist Tamils, a minority ethnic group. These attacks do not appear to be connected to the ethnic conflicts that marked the country's decades-long war, but they do come as a painful reminder of the violence that was once part of daily life on the island.
Sri Lankans, by and large, believe that the war days were behind them. I don't really see this provoking more divisiveness, at least among the general public. However, with some members of the government implying that perhaps other members of the government didn't share intelligence widely enough, it's made it much harder for the political leadership to sort of coalesce. And I don't see this incident improving the situation at all.
For more on what the deadly bombings in Sri Lanka mean for a country less than 10 years removed from civil war, I spoke with Neil Devota. He's a professor of politics and international affairs at Wake Forest University, focusing on South Asia politics. Neil is originally from Sri Lanka, and he told me what he's been hearing from friends and family since these attacks took place.
Absolute disbelief, because Christian churches were not targeted even during the civil war. The LTT, which was the group that fought to create a separate state for the Tamils in the north and northeast of the country, did attack mosques in the eastern province. But churches, Catholic churches, Christian churches were never attacked. So it's absolute sheer disbelief on the part of everybody I know.
And Christians make up a little less than 8% of Sri Lanka's population. What is life like for Christians in the country? Is there discrimination?
Not really. There has been discrimination against evangelical groups, and some of these groups have been targeted by extremist Buddhist forces. There has been some intimidation over the years against Catholics as well, but for the most part, Catholics especially have gotten along quite well. So this was not so much an issue. It was more of an issue between Buddhists and Muslims in the last maybe 5 or 6 years. So as to why these attacks took place in Christian churches is the biggest question that people are trying to answer. And it doesn't seem to me that anyone's come up with, you know, a definitive logical answer to what happened on Easter Sunday.
The Sri Lankan government, Neil, is saying that Muslim extremists were behind these attacks. But have these groups been a threat in Sri Lanka before?
No. Thus far, one of the nagging questions has been why there was no extremist response to some of the attacks the Muslims have experienced starting in 2014. There was an attack on a Muslim settlement in 2014. There were also anti-Muslim riots last year in March. And there was no radical Muslim response. And so this has caught everybody off guard. I suppose it was a matter of time before some of the more extremist elements within the Muslim community retaliated. This seems to be connected to a group called the Tawheed Jamaat, which has a fairly strong presence in Tamil Nadu. That's the state in southern India. And at this point, we do not know what sort of links may have existed between the Tawheed Jamaat in Tamil Nadu and the Tawheed Jamaat in Sri Lanka. But this takes the political situation in Sri Lanka to a whole different level. The scale of the attacks, the coordination, this is unlike anything the country has seen. And this is a country that is used to experiencing suicide bombings, but not at this level of coordination, not at this scale, close to 300 people killed, maybe 500 injured, which suggests that the number of casualties could be even higher.
We also know that hotels were impacted by this bombing. Hotels were also bombed. Let's talk a little bit about the motivation behind that. My understanding is these were 5-star hotels. What could have been the motivation for why those were targeted?
All three hotels are 5-star upscale hotels located fairly close to each other. And if the attacks are in retaliation for what's happened to the Muslim community in the last, 4 to 5 years, and that is what some of the pro-ISIS groups are claiming on social media from what I'm being told, then the bombings in the hotels kind of make sense. This is a response to trying to, make things harder for the economy, cripple the tourism industry and the like. But it still does not explain why a Muslim minority would go against, a Christian minority. Both groups have faced, some discrimination at the hands of the majority Buddhist community over the years. So the hotel bombings do make sense at some level, but not the bombings against the churches.
We also know that Sri Lankan government officials had been warned of a possible attack by the Tawheed Jamaat. What is the situation now?
The government was warned, it turns out, by the Indians, and the warning was sent out on April 11th by the Inspector General of Police. But that intelligence was not shared with the Prime Minister and the Cabinet, and this has to do with some of the tensions that exist between the Prime Minister and the President. The President, it appears, was aware, but the Prime Minister has not been invited to National Security Council meetings in the last few months, given the tense relationship that exists between the two parties. And so this, in that sense, is an intelligence failure, because they knew well ahead of time that the Tawheed Jamaat was planning attacks against Christian churches. So the intelligence was that specific. And so there's bound to be some fallout as a result of, this intelligence failure.
The Sri Lankan authorities have shut down social media following the bombings. And we spoke to the Associated Press reporter Emily Schmall, who told us a little bit about that decision. Let's take a listen.
People are a bit frustrated because, of course, like everywhere, people are accustomed to sharing news on places like Facebook and WhatsApp. And these two social networks in particular have been difficult, if not impossible, to access for most people. On the other hand, I think, you know, the Sri Lankan government is making a statement here by shutting down these networks, saying essentially that they don't really trust these companies to act responsibly.
Neil, a couple questions there. I mean, first of all, what's your take on the social media blackout, the absolute shutdown of social media?
Well, this is understandable given what happened in March last year, where Sinhalese Buddhist extremist groups were coordinating through social media attacks against, you know, the Muslim community. And this went on, I think, for about 3 days. And since then, there's been quite a bit of criticism against Facebook and other groups, claiming that they were not monitoring and shutting down hate speech and the like quickly enough. And so I can see why the government felt like it had to do this. Given what happened last year, I think it was a responsible move. At the same time, I can understand how frustrated people are because I myself could not get in touch with friends. Having grown up close to this church that was bombed in Colombo, I had ample reason to want to make sure that, you know, friends were safe, and I could not get through to them via social media. So I understand the frustration people are experiencing. But at the same time, I can see why the government felt they had to do this. And I can assure you, given what's floating around among some Sri Lankans outside of Sri Lanka, that once this ban is removed, you're going to see quite a bit of hate speech on social media.
So then the question becomes, what will Sri Lanka look like? Will it go back to high security measures after these attacks, after shutting down Facebook, after the number of deaths that it's seen? Do you suspect security in Sri Lanka, both online and offline, to increase in the future?
I think it will. Certainly, you'll see a much higher security presence all over the country, not unsimilar to what existed during the war. It's been extremely easy to access places like hotels, which had pretty high security during the war. But this is a game changer in many ways. But what scares me and what really worries me is what this means for the Muslim community in Sri Lanka going forward, because it's going to be a tough scene for them, because there's always been an eddy of anti-Muslim sentiment in the country that was masked by the civil war. And it was no accident that we saw this anti-Muslim rhetoric and anti-Muslim incidents take place after the civil war ended. And so this Islamophobia trending globally is going to resonate all the more in Sri Lanka, I think, as a result of what's happened.
Neil Devoda is a professor of politics and international affairs at Wake Forest University. Thank you, Neil.
You're very welcome.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're back with The Takeaway. Earlier this month, the House of Representatives took the first step in passing a new version of the Violence Against Women Act. It would help keep guns out of the hands of boyfriends with a history of stalking and harassing, closing the so-called boyfriend loophole in the existing protections. The legislation, which now makes its way to the Senate, comes at a moment when murders committed by spouses and significant others are on the rise. In 2017, more than 6 women a day were killed by a husband, a boyfriend, or an ex. The vast majority of them were shot to death. According to a study of FBI homicide data by Northeastern University, intimate partner homicides increased almost 20% between 2014 and 2017. Despite those figures, the bill has faced major opposition from the NRA, who claimed that the proposal would hamstring gun owners. Democratic Representative Debbie Dingell is a survivor of domestic violence and introduced the legislation. On the floor of the House, Dingell pointed the finger at the organization.
Do not let the NRA bully you. This is not a poison pill.
Dingell reminded fellow representatives that her late husband and predecessor had served on the board of the NRA.
We're not taking away due process. All it does is say that if someone has been convicted as an intimate partner, that they would not have access to a gun.
Currently, law enforcement can take away guns if a woman has a restraining order against a husband, a child, or a cohabitating partner. But that doesn't include if she is dating the person she's accusing.
That's Sarah D. Weyer, congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times.
The Centers for Disease Control has estimated that a half of all women who are killed with a gun are killed by a romantic partner. That equals about 50 women a month. And so you've got a large percentage of women who are in difficult situations that weren't getting the same protections just because of the legal status in the country.
Despite being historically bipartisan, the Violence Against Women Act has stirred controversy in some of its previous iterations, too.
The last few versions of the Violence Against Women Act had some pushback from on the Republican side that it was going too far. The last major fight was over the inclusion of same-sex couples and immigrants. And that actually led to the Violence Against Women Act lapsing for 3 years before they were finally able to come to an agreement. And as Nancy Pelosi said, you know, they made it so politically uncomfortable that eventually the Republicans joined them in passing the bill.
Now it's on to the Senate. And so far, says Sarah, we haven't heard many details on how they plan to move ahead.
Senator Dianne Feinstein and Senator Joni Ernst have said they're going to work on it together. But I'm hearing that those are still in the very early stages of negotiations. Senator Feinstein said that the House bill is a good foundation, but we're hearing that Senator Ernst is less comfortable with the House version, and she wants to see the portions that the NRA has a problem with stripped out before she's willing to put her name on it. I mean, the holdup really does seem like it's going to be this gun violence provision that was inserted by Representative Debbie Dingell in the House. But the Democrats really seem firm on making sure that that stays in. So what that means in the Senate is going to be pretty interesting to watch.
We'll be watching. Thanks to Sarah D. Weyer, congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times, for that background. Our next guest, Courtney Weaver, believes she could have been saved by the House's version of the Violence Against Women Act if it were law. Courtney is a blues singer, and she met the man who would become her abuser after one of her gigs in her early 20s.
2 weeks after we'd met, he came out to see me sing, and he fell in love with me and kind of swept me off my feet, and things moved very, very fast.
6 months into a long-distance relationship, Courtney's boyfriend proposed to her at the fanciest restaurant in town, but getting engaged didn't bring any rush of joy.
It didn't feel like love's supposed to feel. It felt like a way to kind of tie me to him and tether me to him so that I couldn't leave.
There had been warning signs. Her boyfriend had lied about getting into trouble with the law, for example. But when she raised her concerns or tried to set boundaries, he used a combination of charm and force to get Courtney to stick around.
You know, at the time, I was just really flattered that someone liked me so much. I remember him verbally attacking me in front of my mom, and my mom sticking up for me, and she was the only one who told me, she was like, he's going to kill you, Courtney. If you stay with him, he's going to kill you. And I was just really upset.
So she tried to leave him, but when he showed up at her door on Christmas Eve and said he had nowhere else to go, Courtney let him in. A couple weeks later, she says she felt like she needed some distance, so Courtney got ready to go out with some friends.
I was putting makeup on in my bathroom mirror, and I had a four-month-old kitten, who I still have, Raja, and I heard her start to hiss and snarl. And I turned around, and Kenneth had his handgun, and then Raja was on his right arm, and she was just clawing his arm and ripping him to shreds. And I just remember I just started laughing because it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever seen. And I'm one of those people that is that nervous laughter. And he grabbed Raja by her scruff and threw her against my bedroom wall. Everything was moving in slow motion, and I was really scared, and I was just trying to de-escalate him and agree. And he lunged for the door. I put myself between him and the door, and I was fumbling with the deadbolt. And then the next thing I knew, I heard shots firing. And all of a sudden, I was looking up at him, looking up at the blaring light in my kitchen, and the kitchen door window was broken and shattered behind me. And then he ran and was running up the street yelling. And it took me a moment for me to realize that I'd been shot. I jumped up and I realized I couldn't pick up my purse because there was a 3-inch hole in my right arm, in my forearm.
He also shot her in the face.
And I screamed and this blood and teeth and gums came out and I started to run up the street and I heard him up there. And my first neighbor right next on the other side of my duplex didn't answer his door. And so I then zigzagged down the opposite direction of where I heard him because I was just trying to survive at that point. And I was just running on adrenaline.
Courtney managed to find safety with another neighbor. It took an emergency medical crew, an airlift, and a blood transfusion to save her life. And it took many more surgeries to reconstruct her face and salvage her singing voice. Since that day in 2010, Courtney has had a lot of time to reflect and says her mind always returns to what she could have done differently.
What I'd heard is that he'd already engaged and threatened many other people. If he had been prohibited from owning firearms, he would have had a much harder time trying to kill me. And I think that putting the onus of violence on the victim is very naive because there's only so much you can do to stop someone from killing you.
Courtney says she thinks that the Violence Against Women Act should be expanded to close the so-called boyfriend loophole and to protect others from the violence that she experienced.
If there were controls in place that had closed the loophole on him, because he had never been married at the age of 34, that if he had been prevented by a previous partner, that he wouldn't have been able to inflict as much harm as he did, that his behavior would have been hastened. He would have come to the point where maybe he would have realized that he had violent proclivities that he couldn't control. And violent people shouldn't be allowed to own guns. I don't see why that's being contested.
Courtney's ex served 8 years in jail for attempted murder and assaulting a police officer. He was released in September. And Courtney has since filed a protection order against him. But because they were never married and didn't live together, he falls through the boyfriend loophole in federal law.
The man who shot me will be able to get his guns back in 3 years.
That's Courtney Weaver, a blues singer and domestic violence survivor. And the song you're hearing here, it's one she wrote called Stop the Violence.
All this hate has my soul so blue. Doubt and
this weekend marks 20 years since the school shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado. Since then, a Washington Post analysis found there have been more than 230 school shootings that have killed 143 children, educators, and others, and injured another 294 people. So school principals across the country have found themselves dealing with the mental anguish of gun violence in their classrooms. Some have relied on the support of others who have already walked that path. And now the National Association of Secondary School Principals has organized a formal support group called the Principals Recovery Network, and it's made up of 17 current and former principals in schools from 11 states. And we have two of those principals on The Takeaway today. Andy Fetchick was the principal of Chardon High School in Chardon, Ohio, when a 17-year-old student opened fire inside the cafeteria and killed three students in 2012. And George Roberts is the former principal of Perry Hall High School in Baltimore County, where one student shot another in 2012 and attempted to shoot more before being stopped by a teacher. Andy, George, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Andy, what was your focus in the hours and days following the shooting?
After getting through the initial shock and all of that, we worked quite a bit with our superintendent, school leadership, and our goal was to return to school as quickly as possible. From what we were told and what we had researched, all of the experts had encouraged us to return as quickly as possible. Let those students take ownership of that school again. Let them feel safe. Let them feel to whatever it is that normal is going to become again for them. And that was our goal, was to get back into school as quickly as possible.
And George, what about you? What was your focus in the days, in the aftermath of the shooting?
Yeah, very similar to Andy's, wherein, because fortunately we did not have any fatalities in our shooting, the police released the crime scene back into the school system approximately 6 p.m. that afternoon. So our superintendent had decided, for the same reasons Andy just referenced, to get the kids back into school as soon as possible so we could get them the supports and begin the healing process. So we opened actually the next day. And so my immediate plan was how to open, the logistics around opening, and getting the support needed for our kids and our teachers, staff, and parents.
Andy, when did you realize you needed help?
I think immediately. This is not something that has a playbook. There's no course. You don't study this. So once we started to talk about all of the things that we're going to need to consider, mental health supports, returning to school, the actual physical nature of cleaning up a crime scene. None of those things that I've ever worked with before. So from probably those first moments, I knew this was going to be something that will change my life.
Did you understand at the time that you needed, or were you even aware that there were other folks out there, principals like yourself, who had experienced the same thing? Had you even thought that there was a network, sad as it may be?
I knew that there was some history to this, but I didn't know to what extent that I know now. You know, having had the opportunity to get together at the National Association of Secondary School Principal Office with all of these other school leaders recently, until then, I had never been able to put faces to the names, and they were just schools.
George, what about you? What was your experience like when you realized you personally needed more support?
Yeah, that actually was maybe a two-phase approach. It was certainly that evening, once the adrenaline had left my system late that evening when I got home, had a chance to speak with my wife and, quite frankly, you know, cry with my wife and go through that. That was the moment I realized, you know, this was certainly a heavy burden. Shortly thereafter, about a day or two after, I received a call from Bill Bond, who was a victim. His school was a victim of school shooting in 1998, 1 year before Columbine. So in speaking with him and coordinating with him, really found the personal and school and community support that Bill was able to help us through, and then letting me and allowing me to talk through what had happened in our school.
What's unique about your role as a principal and the others that you talk to in this group in these circumstances?
There's a sense of isolation. I don't believe it's intended. I think it's an organic sense that principals probably put on themselves because the academic responsibilities, the school climate, the culture, all of those things are part of the principal's role. So when you look at returning to school and you look at the mental health of those students, I think that becomes just an overwhelming task that it doesn't appear there's any right answer.
George, when I'm sure when either of you signed up to be school principals, this was not part of the job description. How do you feel about that, George? That now being a principal, I mean, I come from a family of educators, for example. Educators have to think about this now. Families, children have to think about this, but so do you guys.
Yeah, no, and I would go a step further to say that everyone needs to think about it. That most acts of violence, particularly with guns, happens in the business environment. You know, schools, when you look at the list, rank down on the list, not where you would think they would be, at the top of the list. So certainly to your point about educators, yeah, it's something that unfortunately we have to live with now. There are courses that I'm aware of being offered at the university level around just school safety and how to manage, how to create plans, implement plans, recovery plans. So it's certainly a reality of our lives, and it's one that's here to stay, and I think our university partners are seeing that.
Does that frustrate you, though, that you have to add this layer of security and all these other, you know, anti-violence measures to what is supposed to be an educational and safe environment?
Yeah, absolutely. Without a doubt. Yeah, there's a lot of frustration there. We shouldn't have to be in working. We dedicated our lives and dedicate our lives to children. And so this type of violence, this type of level of violence is not one that we trained for or expected to should have to deal with. But it's a reality. So I think to stick our heads in the sand and pretend and hope it's not going to happen is would be irresponsible of us. So I think we need to be prepared. It's an unfortunate reality and one we're going to have to move forward with and prepare for.
And Andy, do you have any messages for other educators or folks that may be working in schools, parents who may be listening?
I think it's important that we continue to voice our concerns. I'm not choosing a side on gun control or not. I'm only advocating for what I believe to be right. And I think that's the message we need to continue to share with our stakeholders, is that we all have a voice, and we need to act on that. We need to vote, and we need to be vocal and share our concerns.
Is there anything that you would like to say to each other or to other principals out there?
I think from my perspective, I think for other principals who have to suffer through these tragedies, to know that we're here, that NASSP has done a phenomenal job of bringing us together and supporting and forming this network. So we're here. We cross the country. So anyone who needs us for any reason, please call on us.
Absolutely. And we're here to listen as well. I think that's the key. When those events happen and school violence occurs, it's important to know there's a voice out there that can listen and share an experience that, fortunately, not everyone has gone through.
George Roberts is community superintendent for Baltimore County Public Schools and former principal of Perry Hall High School in Baltimore County. And Andy Fetchick is director of human resources for Mayfield City Schools in Ohio and former principal of Chardon High School in Chardon, Ohio. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.